Testing, test, 1, 2. Test, 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 1, 2.
Can you just try the other three, the other two mics?
Testing, test, test. Test, test.
That's kind of faint.
Test, test.
The volume here. Yeah, this is the volume. Hey, Alex, speak into that mic right there. That one, yeah.
Testing, testing, testing. Testing, testing, 1, 2. Testing, 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 mic 1. Testing, 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 1, 2. Testing, 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 mic 1, 2.
I wonder if those speakers there are connected to by having that extension cord, if that makes it a little.
Testing, 1, 2.
Let me try this one here.
Particular. I could hear this one perfectly.
Testing, 1, 2, 3. Testing, 1, 2, 3.
That's fine.
That was just that moment.
Try it again.
Testing, testing, 1, 2, 3. Testing, 1, 2. Testing, 1, 2, 3.
Something wrong with the cord.
I think it's this cord, maybe your cord.
Not connected to my cord. It's just your cord.
This one is just all the way through?
Yeah.
I wonder if it's more long.
No, it's not. It's bumpy.
There shouldn't be an order to the lights, right?
I can hear it becoming louder and softer and louder. Still very faint.
It's faint, yeah. So you think we got a bad cord? Well, that's fine for each one. Sure, Alex, go ahead. Try it again. Because you can hear this one, right? You can hear testing, testing. That's clear. Can you hear I'm talking? Can you hear me in any of the other mics? Can you put your headset on? Testing 1, 2, 3. Testing 1, 2, 3. Can you hear anything? Okay. Maybe these others will pick it up. Okay. These are all. This is a handheld one. Well, I really appreciate the call. Thank you. So I'll stop this and then I can just restart it.
This meeting of the Senate Health, Housing, and Family Security Committee will come to order. I wanted to start with Dave Williams from Mankato State University, who wanted to welcome us to campus, and we feel welcome, but please go ahead.
Distinguished Senators, it's a privilege to have you here on our campus. I bring welcome from President Richard Davenport, who would love to be here. He's testifying in Duluth for our Minnesota State College and University system on tuition issues, something very partnership we have with the legislature to help make education for our Minnesota students better and better. We hope as this is valuable to them for you today. I know we have a great number of guests and visitors, but simply to say welcome to our campus. I hope you have time to look around a little and see some of the work that we're doing. Thank you for being here.
Well, thank you very much for the welcome, and it is a beautiful campus and good things happening here, so appreciate that. The Senate Health, Housing, and Family Security Committee is going to be having a series, a number of hearings, not too many, but a few of them around the state to hear input, because next year we will be looking at a number of health care reform bills, and Senator Sharon, not only being a member of the Senate, but also a registered nurse and particularly concerned about health care. When she heard we were going to have some hearings, she invited us to come to Mankato for the first one. And is that if you want to say a few words, Senator Sharon? Thank you for the invitation.
Well, thank you very much, Senator Marty. I am absolutely thrilled that the Legislative Senate Committee on Health is here to hear testimony and hear from our community. The members of this committee and the members of the committee that I serve on, which is the budget committee that in the end tries to put the money behind what the policy discussions are that this committee moves forward, are very interested in trying to find ways to make healthcare affordable, accessible, improve its quality. And so that's what we're here to listen to. What's happening? We want to hear your testimony about that. All of us are very interested not only in ongoing short-term kinds of remedies that we need in order to make the system more accessible, more affordable, but also a longer-term structural change. So as I'm listening and as committee members are listening, we're listening for what the short-term goals are and the short-term needs are, but also listening for guidance from you about what might we be able to do structurally to change the way we provide healthcare services so that we can contain the costs, make sure everybody has access to healthcare, so that we can get people strong healthcare services early and avoid the long-term costly healthcare, and also make certain that everybody has access. So thank you so much for coming. I appreciate your being here. I look forward to hearing your guidance and your message to us today.
Thank you, Senator Sharon, and it is a pleasure to be here. I think we all are here because we understand the problems with access to affordable health care has reached a crisis stage in Minnesota. We're hearing from businesses who can no longer afford to continue providing coverage. We're hearing from people who are saying, you know, we can't afford health care insurance. And we're hearing from people who have health care coverage who can't afford their prescriptions or their exclusions or the co-pays and deductibles are such that it's causing a problem. And I think many of you have heard that number one cause of bankruptcy in this country is now health care. And that's not that number of people who are uninsured. Most of those folks, three-quarters of the folks who are bankrupt because of health care, are people who had coverage at the time of a major illness that put them over the edge. So we're interested in hearing your stories on that. And we have, I'll just give a few of the groundwork types of things. But first of all, one of the purposes of this is to get the background. Every community in the state has facing the healthcare crisis, but each region of the state has slightly different angles on it, different concerns. And so coming out to Mankato to hear the people in surrounding communities here with their concerns would be helpful to us. And again, when we address healthcare, I think if we see the problem as something for 7 or 8% of the population that has no coverage, if that's what we're going to address, then we're not going to do anything for the other 92% who are very much on the edge of losing their health care coverage. After we go through and introduce committee members, I will ask people, we have a few names who had signed up ahead of time, and then we'll take anybody who wants to speak, but I will ask people to try and hold your testimony to about 3 minutes. So we can get to everyone. We want to quit before 2 o'clock if we can. But we'd like you to talk about problems you've seen with access to health care, whether based on your personal experience. I see some people who look like they're medical professionals, your professional experience, the problems you've seen and comments you want to make about it and comments about what you'd like to see health care reform address. We're not here today to talk about any specific reforms, specific legislation. We're here to talk about the whole concept, what needs to be included. And I distributed to committee members and so on a list of what I think we should include as requirements. This was similar to what we passed earlier this year in committee, a list of what I would call requirements for what healthcare reform should include, including ensuring all Minnesotans have access to high-quality healthcare regardless of income, that we don't restrict or deny care in order to save money. That's been the government approach. That's been the approach of a lot of people. If it's too expensive, you buy less of it. But unfortunately, people who, with healthcare, when you buy less of it, it doesn't mean people stop getting sick. Sometimes they get sicker because of it. I want to make sure, I think healthcare reform has to cover all necessary healthcare. Why dental care is always separate is beyond me. It's one area where we do good at prevention. Chemical dependency, mental health, but make sure we cover a comprehensive list of services. So if you have any particular aspects, if you're having trouble, if you have health care coverage but certain things are excluded, and that's a particular concern, we'd like to hear what you want to make sure we address when we're addressing health care reform. And although people who are having specific problems with the health care system may be angry at a particular provider or health plan, we hope you can, as much as possible, focus on the broader cause of it. If the healthcare providers, if the health plan, somebody's making too much money, you can say that, but let's not go too much into the particular person or institution. We're more interested in the broader picture. And again, if you can, try and keep your testimony to about 3 minutes. It would be very helpful so we can make sure everybody has a chance. But before we begin, I'd like to begin having members of the committee introduce themselves. Senator Dahl, would you like to begin? Say where you're from as well. So help.
Thank you. I'm Senator John Dahl, District 40, that's Burnsville, part of Bloomington. And I'm a freshman senator. Last year in campaigning, going door to door, health care was the number one issue at the door. And I know that in talking with my colleagues who are new members as well, this is the same throughout the state. It's health care, the cost, the access to it, from pharmaceuticals to just long-term issues. These things are issues that we have to address. It's going to take a lot of effort on all of our parts to make that a reality, to find solutions. So I'm really happy that all of you have shown up today, because we're not going to find those solutions just down at the Capitol. It's going to happen from around the state, ideas from you, bringing those in. And that's why we're here, because I know not all of you can come down to the Capitol. But to bring these ideas forward, we can find solutions and start to build a foundation that will lead towards some sort of universal health care. But thank you for all coming today.
Well, thank you very much, Senator Paul Coring from the beautiful Brainerd Lakes area. And I want to thank everybody for coming to this committee meeting, because this is an important issue. And I see a lot of familiar faces in here. I see Tom Peterson from Farmers Union. He continues to be concerned about this issue, and I appreciate his advocacy on this. I introduced myself to a young man from Congressman Walz's office, and he's here taking notes, and I appreciate that. So, but I appreciate all you being here, and we certainly want to hear your input. And on a beautiful day like today, you could be doing a lot of other things, but it shows your passion for this issue. Thank you.
Since Senator Sharon introduced herself, and I didn't, I'm Senator John Hardy from Roseville, and chairing the committee. And again, I'm very pleased with the welcome we've had here, and look forward to hearing the stories.
And I'm Katie Kavanaugh from the Office of Senate Counsel and Research.
Good afternoon. I'm Senator Ann Lynch. I represent the areas of Rochester, Plainview, Stuartville, Chatfield, Dover, Eota, and Elgin. And it is really a treat and a privilege to be here in Senator Sharon's district today.
I'm David Hand. I represent Eden Prairie and part of Minnetonka. I'm starting my second term in the Senate, but first year on Senator Marty's committee. And we're all very interested in this topic, and we appreciate very much your taking the time to come out today to meet with us.
I'm Senator Tony Lorry from Senate District 8, which is pretty much the I-35 corridor between Duluth and the Twin Cities. I think that my son and I have the distinction of having driven the farthest today to get here. It was a beautiful day for the drive. We have our hay drying in the field, so it was a good day to come down here. We'll go put it up tomorrow. And thank you all for coming to share your stories about the healthcare situation in Minnesota, and we really look forward to getting those stories and finding solutions for how to move Minnesota forward on this critical issue. Thanks again.
And with that, we will begin the testimony, and when you come, if it's appropriate, we'll please give your name, and if it's appropriate, maybe your occupation, especially if you work in the field of healthcare. If you feel it's appropriate or you're willing to do so, the community you're from, any other background you think would be helpful to the committee. And the first witness I have on the list is Dr. Ann Vogel from the Open Door Health Center in Mankato.
Thank you for this great opportunity. We'll turn it on.
This mic.
This one. We'll have to get to the right microphone. How's that?
Very good.
Okay. I have 3 minutes. I talk very fast. I promise not to talk too fast, but thanks for all your time in coming here. And I want to also say I understand the hay is in the field, and the fact that you're here is most impressive, as it is for the rest of you. I work at Open Door Health Center and have been here since January as a full-time physician in the year 2005. And I've been practicing in a different setting. I've worked in several clinics, and I've been born and raised and lived in southern Minnesota all my life. I come from New Ulm. I drive from New Ulm every day and come over here to Open Door. And I see a population that I have never seen in my 30-plus years of medicine in the numbers. And there are definitely huge numbers that are uninsured or underinsured. And most of these people are working, the majority are. And they have full-time or part-time jobs, and they've fallen through cracks. And as I heard one time on public radio, if you live in this country and have good insurance, you are in a very favored position. And if you have no insurance, you're in the country of hurt. So we see the people who feel they're living in the country of hurt every day. We do have 6% of our patients who are privately insured. All the rest are either uninsured or underinsured. 35% of the population does not speak English as a primary language. Most of those do not have much facility in English, and I am not bilingual. We do have bilingual staff at the front desk, and also a nurse who is trained in Mexico, who is not here as a licensed RN, but is acting really in our clinic as a community health worker. That's a new job description that I think all the legislators have to listen about. They're training the people, we gotta find jobs for them. They are the connections between the people out there who don't have insurance and the ones who are looking for how to improve their health or take care of their health. Let me give you just a couple snapshots of people that we saw. There is a 57-year-old man who has 2 years of college education in journalism. He hasn't been able to get a full-time job. He's part-time. He's coming to us because of the medication assistance program. We recently had a survey, and we asked him what he thought of the care. He just said he's not making comment except he considers it a godsend. He is on a number of psychotropic drugs, and when he's on his medicine, he does very well. He also has a liver disorder, which puts him at high risk for heart disease. He wants to stay healthy, and he wants to stay in the work field. He can't afford the medicines. They're too expensive. In spite of some of the medication assistance programs that we have developed, we are looking at some possibilities of getting a wider service area to include the East Ridge Clinic over at the eastern side next to the water tower if you came in from that area with the University of Minnesota Family Practice Department. I think it's a glowing opportunity to do something about this. In order to have that work, people cannot do this for nothing. When I came in the year 2005, we were losing about $68 on every person who came into the office. We have volunteers, we have grants, we have donations that are given. This community has been pouring out lots of help in volunteer dollars and service in kind for a couple decades now, at least for the last decade in particular. That needs to be nourished and cultivated so we don't lose it. And for that, if we're going to make an affiliation with another program called the Family Practice Medicine Department through the university that's housed over at East Ridge with the Mayo Health System being the site, it's going to take some money. Right now, in 2 years, we managed to lose $40 on every patient coming in. So we're making headway. We also have a line of credit that we're responsible for, and I've never practiced in my entire life where I say every day, did we make any money? That's just counter to what I like to do with patients, but it's important to keep the door open. Another patient that we had actually was Spanish-speaking only. She appeared in our door. She is 60-some years of age, and she speaks Spanish only. She was born in Mexico. She is here now because her husband sponsored her, and she's a legal immigrant, and she has no access to health care. In fact, she's over 60. The Medicare patient who comes to our country, who joins somebody here who's become a citizen, is not going to have access to health care. And she has multiple problems. She has a diagnosis of diabetes. And if you understand a little bit about diabetes, and I know that Senator Sharon will know, if your diabetes is well controlled, you're in the 6 to 7% range of A1C. Hers was 15. She had hypertension. Her blood pressure was 200 over 150. She ran out of medication. She came to us because she wanted medicine so she could get back on track. Where do these people go? We have a system at Open Door that's not going to be sustainable in the future. I'm the only full-time physician. We have a restricted budget. We've cut down on our staff hours, and the patients keep coming in the door. If we can develop a partnership in the region to take care of the lower one-third of Minnesota, which is what the Open Door Health Center has been designated to serve. This is a medically underserved population. There are 24 federally qualified health centers or lookalikes, which is what we are, in the state, 7 in northern Minnesota, all the rest in the urban area, and 1 to serve the lower part of Minnesota, the lower one-third. We're an agricultural part of the state. We have lots of people, whether they're documented or not, many of them are. They're on temporary jobs or seasonal jobs. They're working at all the food processing plants. They're taking care of processing turkeys. And they're also taking care of egg production. And they're taking care of the corn pack and the pea pack. And these people need to stay healthy. And there's a high incidence of diabetes among the Hispanic population. And in fact, we saw, and these are things I'm going to submit to the committee because I know I shouldn't talk much longer, of the number of diabetics that we've seen. But the numbers are really quite astounding. We have a dental clinic and a medical clinic, and in 2006, we saw a total of 5,900 patients, and of those, 1,200 were fully employed, about 1,000 were part-time employed, and others had seasonal work. So those are some numbers you might be interested in. The number of diabetic patients that we saw in the year 2006 was 519 diabetic visits, with 179 diabetics. People who had high lipids, many of you know about those, you have high lipids, and if you're high risk for heart disease, we saw 131 that we diagnosed and followed them over a period of time, 231 visits. Hypertension, a big cause of strokes if left unattended, or congestive heart failure. We saw a new number of patients last year, 230, and of those visits, 374. Now, if you listen to those numbers, these people aren't coming in overutilizing services. They say, can I come back in 6 months instead of 4? And they listen. When I ask them to do certain things that will help make their health better, they come back. They lose weight. The patient I saw today, I saw her 6 weeks ago. She lost 12 pounds. She's a borderline diabetic, and she's on medication, and she listens to every word I say through the interpreter. And if I give them too much information, which I'm prone to do sometimes, is she'll say as the interpreter is going out the door, didn't she say she's going to give me something about a diet and tell me how much I should exercise every day and what should I do for my feet? So listening to someone talk like I do in English and work through an interpreter, which is key, patients just are like sponges. They want to stay working, and they don't ask me for slips that says, could you please say I can't work? We had a patient who had multiple myeloma. He eventually was taken care of through the regional system. He didn't have insurance. Eventually that got worked out in some way. Very expensive for the institution that's going to take care of him. And he did not want a slip that said, I can't go to work. Your normal hemoglobin is 12 to 14 grams. His was 7. He should have been real tired, and he was. But he wanted to go to work because the money was going to be sent to family that he was going to support. No way was he going to ask for hours off. So I think I've given you enough of a gloss. So other people who have very important things to say, I just want you to know I'm convinced after being here since January 2005, we have enough medical personnel and talent within this part of the state that this is an opportunity. I hope we get some funding. So University of Minnesota program is going to fly, and we're going to be training new doctors that will be staying in the area. We should not let this fall through our fingers. And I think whatever it takes, state and federal wide, we should try and make something that's going to impact this population, because they're fun to take care of, they're very challenging, and they're worth all the effort. Thank you for your time.
Thank you. Dr. Vogel, quick question about the clientele. You said like 500-some diabetic mm-hmm. visits in a year. You are obviously giving them as much preventive care and how to prevent it from getting worse. How many people does anybody come to initially for preventive care, or basically, we're sick now, we need your help now?
That's an excellent question. Our approach is being a federally qualified health center. If you look at what the requirements are, we're supposed to give comprehensive care, including the preventive mode. So if a patient comes in and they have a sore throat and I say, when's the last time you saw a doctor? 6 years ago. When was your last pap smear? 5 years ago. Did you ever have a mammogram? You're over the age of 40. All of a sudden, that sore throat turns into a longer visit, and I get them set up and say, have you ever been out of your family history? Oh, your father died at age 50, and you had a sister, you know, who had cancer at this age. Then I quickly put down what your risk factors are, and these are the things would you be willing to come back and pay for, and it's reasonable. Come back for a lipid screen, come back for a blood sugar if four members of your immediate family had diabetes, and they come back, even though they have to get off work, which is, you know, very hard for them to do. So we do a lot of prevention. We ask them about the immunization status. We hit hard on tobacco use. The Minnesota Quit Line, we give it out all the time. And we ask every time they come back, did you call? This is just it's such a good deal. We've got tobacco, you know, settlement money that's being paid for. We even made out slips. We've called that center ourselves and said, what do you hear? Do you give it to them in Spanish? And the answer is yes. We tell them what hours they're open, so when they call, they don't get one of these, you know, revolving wheels. And I can tell you, some of these people are actually quitting smoking. We say it may take 7 to 8 times, but you've done it once, good. That's one down. And we just keep banging away at it, because that's one of the cancers that we can definitely make a dent on. But we have to inspire the patient and enable them to actually succeed.
Are there any other questions from members of the committee?
Dr. Vogel, you said you were a FQHC lookalike?
Yes. A lookalike means that we are allowed to get as many patients as possible on an MA insurance plan. And we have to kind of lead them to that, because it's very complicated. You know how thick the packet is. And then we get reimbursed at a higher rate, which allows us to continue to take care of those kinds of patients. We applied for a grant, and there were very few that were granted throughout the United States. And I may have the numbers not quite right, but it was 120 or more that they were going to grant new START funding, which would have brought $650,000 into this community for the next 3 years for capital improvement. And it was not successful. And that's not surprising, because the competition out there is very steep. You've got Katrina, you've got places down in the South that are a lot worse off than we are. Tell you, our health care disparity in the minority group is as acute as it is other parts. It's just that we have such good health care that gets kind of lost. So we have FQHC lookalike, which allows us to see dental patients at a higher reimbursement rate. It gives us some other privileges as far as being able to buy medications at a reduced cost. That will be key if we can actually have a successful University of Minnesota residency program kind of meld with us. And our overflow, they're going to be prepared to take care of more medical patients. The capacity is there. But the dental clinic has to be preserved. It's amazing how dental health impacts on all the rest of the things, including coronary artery disease and premature labor, and we can just go right down the line. And they have a successful dental clinic. They've got some grants. And, you know, we have to keep that going until we can fix it. All of us, including the legislators in particular, can fix this hole we've got in our safety net. We are the safety net for Southern Minnesota. So lookalike means we didn't get money, we can't hire more people, we have to keep restricted hours, we can work longer, but you know, human effort has a finite point. And I'm just pleading to say, we got trained people here. We have a lot of really very well-trained medical personnel, ancillary, nursing, physicians, and if we can get, you know, a little bit of funding that will assure us no unmatched mandates, we can move forward.
Thank you very much for your testimony.
You.
Very helpful. The next person I have on the list is Nita Austin from Nipawin County Public Health. Oh, and there's another person from Lynn Soho as well.
Yes, I'm not Nita.
Nita's here.
But she is here, yes.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you.
Senator Sharon and Senator Martin, thank you for being here, and all the rest of the guests. I'd like to say a few words about dental care access for our Niklet County clients. And these are clients who are on medical assistance or one of the state health care plans, such as the Minnesota Senior Health Options. I'm Lynn Solo. I'm a public health nurse. I have worked for Niklet County for about 19 years. A good number of those were first in home care. I was a home care nurse. And the past six or seven, I have worked in the Wayward Services Division. It's our job there to assess people for their health care needs and then help them get hooked up with providers who can help them meet those needs. I'd just like to tell you about a client of mine who I will call Nick. He's a 22-year-old young man who has spastic quadriplegia, which is a form of cerebral palsy. He's confined to a wheelchair, and he does have a job. He contributes to his family's income. He's big brother to four younger sisters. He lives with his parents and his family in North Mankato. Now, his parents asked me to help him find a dentist. Now, Nick lives about four blocks from a dental clinic in one direction and maybe about a half mile from a dental clinic in the other direction. And this was their preferred. They wanted to be seen by one of those clinics. And he could easily get there in his wheelchair, and it's a motorized wheelchair, and he could just sit in that and motor on down and get his teeth checked. However, neither one of those clinics would accept his medical assistance as payment. I called a lot of other dental clinics in the area and got the same answer. And finally, I had to make an appointment for him at a clinic up in Savage, which I knew was accepting medical assistance as a payment source. Now, Savage is 63 miles from Mankato. Nick is not alone. Last week, I emailed my coworkers and asked them where their clients are going for their dental care. And these are the answers I received. Le Sueur, which is 22 miles from North Mankato. Blooming Prairie, which is 57 miles. St. James, 39 miles. Medelia, 20. Faribault, 43 miles. And yes, others go to Savage. Now, Nick's father drove him to Savage. But because he's in a wheelchair, Nick is entitled to special transportation in a van that will accommodate his wheelchair. If he had gone by special transportation, the cost would have been $204 according to our local provider of wheelchair transportation. I sent an elderly lady up to Le Sueur to have her dentures fixed, and UCARE furnished her with a ride through Vine Faith in Action, which has volunteer drivers. Vine is reimbursed at the rate of 64 cents per mile for providing that transportation, reimbursed by medical assistance. So therefore, if we add that up, it comes to $28 for the transportation for this person to get to her dental care. And it seems to me that these are hidden costs of the dental care. Some of our clients live in foster homes, and because of the extra time to transport them, that adds extra time to staff personnel. So far, I've only spoken of the financial part of the issue. As one of our social workers pointed out, our clients and their families pay a price, too. It takes a strong person with the know-how to transfer Nick, who's a big guy at about 180 pounds, from his wheelchair into the car, out of the car, back to the wheelchair, and in and out of the dental chair, and the reverse, going back home again. For our elderly clients, this is a long day. They return from their visits exhausted. They're tired. They pay for it for days afterwards because they have increased arthritic pain. They're just out of energy. I have here a map of Minnesota that shows healthcare professional shortage areas for dental care in Minnesota. I'm sure you can't see that from here, but our area is not one of the dental shortage areas. So, with 9 pages of dentists and dental advertisements in the Mankato area phone book, you'd think that we could find a dentist for one of our clients. So what's the problem? I'm certain there's no easy answer. I've been told that medical assistance reimbursement does not even cover the cost of a dental visit. I've also been told that this population has a high rate of no-shows at their appointments. I've also been told that, no, we really do need more dentists in our area. I don't know what the answer is, and I'm guessing that it's quite complex. My coworkers and I do make use of the Open Door Clinic, and we're glad that they are in town. But more and more often, we're finding that they are full. They simply cannot take any more clients. We use the dental program at Minnesota State University here, and we use UCARE's mobile dental unit. Those last two resources only do preventive health. If a person needs restorative care, once again, we're back to square one and trying to find a dentist somewhere in the area. I want to thank you for listening, and also thank you for passing the no smoking legislation. And we are ready to work with you towards getting some more local dental care for our clients. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Solo. And that was Senator Sharon's bill that passed this year.
Yes.
We're very pleased it to be. Any questions from the committee? Senator Hand.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And Ms. Solo, on the map that you showed us, it looked like about half the state, I guess in terms of counties, has a shortage of dental care professionals. And just
that's true.
Do you have any reason, or what's the underlying cause of the shortage? Do you have any sense of that?
I only know what I've heard, and I understand that dentists will take only so and so many clients who are on medical assistance and then stop taking them. Maybe dentists don't want to practice in rural areas. I don't know, though according to this, we're a rural area and we have adequate coverage. I would think that if they are taking on clients who don't show up, they lose, they're losing that time, they're losing that income. I don't have any easy answers for you, no.
Senator Cora, Chairman and Senator Hamm, what the problem is the, I don't want to blame this on us, but it's the old adage of there's never enough money to pay for everything, and we're not reimbursing the dentist, we're reimbursing them about 50% of their cost. And so I've got the same problem up in Brainerd, where the dentists are getting paid. The dentists
are getting paid 50% of what their costs are, and there is a huge amount of people that will schedule an appointment and then they don't show up. If they come to get their teeth cleaned, then that professional is waiting there and nobody showed up and they're still paying them. So we've got a problem there, and so I don't know how we're going to try to increase that reimbursement rate or try to figure out some incentives to these dentists so that they will offer those services, because they're just not doing it right now because they're losing money on it.
Right.
Yeah.
Part of what public health can do is when we run across clients for whom we're making dental appointments or helping make dental appointments is make sure that they do have transportation, that they have childcare, or whatever else is necessary to get them there.
Thank you very much, Ms. Solo. Do I take it that Ms. Austin, she had more to add, or you're speaking for her?
I am speaking for her, yes, thank you.
Well, thank you very much for your testimony. Next person I have is John Thormanson. Welcome to the committee, sir.
Thank you. Good afternoon, members of the committee. I am John Thormanson from Medalia, Minnesota. It's a couple towns to the west of here on Highway 60. I live in the southeast corner of Brown County. I commonly refer to myself as a peon in the corner of the county. My wife Brenda and I have two children, Jana, soon to be age 10 next week, and Jason, age 7. We grow corn, soybeans, and oats on our farm. Brenda and the kids are currently working with 200 feeder pigs on flat floor and 10 steers. Jana likes the pigs and Jason likes the steers, and yes, Dad does help some too. I'm here today to tell the members of this committee some of the health care dilemmas my family has had. When you have kids, high infections come up, ear infections come up, and it's not always Monday through Friday when those happen. So when some of these things happen, my wife kind of asks me or hesitates, well, should we try and wait it out till Monday? Or should we go ahead and bite the bullet and take them to the emergency room? Well, I always say the eyes and the ears are two pretty precious parts of the body, and it's pretty hard to replace them. So Dad says get them up to the Newall Medical Center. That's where my wife and children doctor. My boy, one time he had an ear infection on a weekend, and when we got the bill for the emergency room, my wife couldn't believe it. It was $500, and I think it was just that was just for the bill for the room. And with an ear infection, you know there's no blood. It was just to go sit there and get diagnosed, and that was it. But it was $500. Why should parents have to debate whether or not to take their child for medical care, whether it's Monday or Saturday or Sunday? It's frustrating. I have also thought about not having insurance, but what if? My loan officer would frown on it at the bank if I do not have health insurance. That's something asked every January when I get an envelope from my bank. I am supposed to list my insurances on there, life insurance, health insurance, whatever. If I would not write down on there that I'd carry health insurance, I'm sure my credit score at the bank would drop and my checkbook would have to get opened up more to pay a higher interest rate. I'm paying enough now. These are a couple of things my family and I have been through. And every winter when our insurance is up for renewal, yes, the premium goes higher. We have gone up around 25% in 2 years. Then there's the prescriptions. My wife needs some eye drops that cost $118 a month, and my daughter needs some medication for ADD that costs $114 a month. Altogether, then, with our health insurance and these two prescriptions, we are paying over $650 per month. For comparison, I try and catch the news once in a while, and sometimes I miss on the local here at 6 o'clock, so I turn on Channel 5 at 6:30. And I happen to see a commercial on there where Denny Hecker's advertising that you can lease a Cadillac Escalade for just slightly more than what I'm paying for my health insurance and my two prescriptions per month. Let's not make healthcare a status symbol. It's time for government to take care of its people. We should not have to go to Mexico, which we have done for my wife's eye drops to cut costs. We can go over the bridge to Progreso, Mexico, and buy two bottles of eye drops for what one costs up here. Or why should people have to send mail orders to another country? The local pharmacy should be the natural choice. My Medalia High School English teacher, Bob Moe, taught us students that we should give two positives for every one negative in speech class. My ratio might not be right, but I have some good things to say about healthcare. Come to the small town of Medalia. The people support our fire department and our rescue squad. We have a relatively new clinic attached to our hospital. Our hospital is currently in a second remodeling project in less than 10 years. It is also nice to have a physical therapy department that is completely staffed and equipped in the hospital basement. Unfortunately, I've been a patient there a couple of times. I also want to say something about where my wife doctors and where my children were born and doctored, which is Newall Medical Center, another facility with caring staff and excellent facilities, 25 minutes from our farm. The people that live west of Mankato are lucky to have these fine facilities in Medalia and Duwalm. In closing, I would like to say healthcare costs are significant for me, and we do not know our income until our produce is sold. A mother or father should not have to second-guess themselves if they feel their child needs medical care because they are afraid of an emergency room bill. I would ask the members of the committee to work towards making health care something that is granted. Let us not take health care to the level of the Cadillac Escalade. Thank you to the members of the committee for coming out here to rural Minnesota today and hearing us.
Thank you, Mr. Thormitson. Your comments, I've never heard anyone say what you said at the beginning about how your loan officer at the bank wants to know if you're insured. I guess it shouldn't be a surprise to me, but I had never heard somebody talk about how they had to have it in order to get a loan because they want to make sure you're able to be working. Yeah.
Yes.
Senator Corrin.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman, and I want to thank
Thormitson.
Thormitson.
Yes.
I want to thank you for your testimony, and I just want to give you one. You know, we're hearing a lot of stories that are troubling, and I want to just throw a positive thing out that happened this legislative session is, and something that I and Tom Peterson and others have been working on for the last
5 years. When I first got elected in 2003, I had a young fella who was a dairy farmer in my district, and I was a dairy farmer, so I understand how hard he works. And he at the time in 2003, he had three kids, all under the age of 18, and his wife, for what circumstances I don't know, but she was not in the picture. She had left, and so he had Minnesota Care. And when he went to apply, which you do every year, there used to be an add back of depreciation. I don't know if you're aware of that, where he had $14,885 worth of income, but he had $33,000 worth of depreciation, and what they did is they'd add that into the income, and they'd say, oh, you're making too much money. And so they kicked him off of Minnesota Care, and so to go and get health care coverage for him and his three kids, it was $1,200 a month, and he couldn't afford it. So it took us 5 years to get that changed, but we did get it changed. The legislature got it changed this year, and so that's going to be a good thing to help folks like you, I think, that are farming, and so I think that's a positive step in the right direction. Thanks for your testimony.
Any other questions from the committee? No, thank you very much, Mr. Thormitson.
Thank you.
Next person I have is somebody who had to leave at 1, Liz Doyle. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Adjust my microphone here. My name is Liz Doyle, and I'm the Policy Director of Take Action Minnesota, which is a social, racial, and economic justice organization that works statewide here in Minnesota. We are in the process of launching a campaign here in Minnesota to try to engage thousands of Minnesotans across the state on exactly this issue, healthcare, and how we can move toward better quality, more affordable health care for everyone in this state. Our organization has knocked on about 6,000 doors around Minnesota this year to talk to voters about health care and what this issue has meant for their families. And in the next 15 months, we'll be knocking on another 60,000 doors, different parts of the state, to talk to voters about health care. Now, it's been clear to us in those kind of face-to-face conversations how much health care and the health care crisis, as mentioned at the opening of the hearing today, really is crossing the lines of race and geography and age and income all over the state of Minnesota. And so appreciate the invitation to come today and just spend a minute or two talking about some of the stories that we've heard as we've been knocking on doors in different parts of the state and talking to people about how healthcare has impacted their families. Let me start by mentioning a woman named Lynn, who lives in Minnetonka, Minnesota. So a few of us are familiar with that. It's a fairly well-to-do suburb of Minneapolis. Lynn and her husband have always worked, always had a steady job and steady income and good quality health insurance. Then about 5 years ago, Lynn's husband was diagnosed with kidney disease. And in the process of him going through his treatments, they realized that the health insurance policy that he had through his employer had been changed over the course of the years that he's been employed there and no longer covered transplants.
So that was a kind of shocking discovery for that family. When we had spoken to Lynn at her door at the beginning of this year, her husband was in dialysis. He was pretty much in limbo as they were waiting for Lynn to try to find a job, a different job on her own that might provide a better, more comprehensive health care benefit package for their family. She said to us at that point, we used to have good quality health insurance and not anymore. And I think that was a story that we heard a lot as we've talked to different folks around the different communities on this issue. Another person we spoke with was Diane, who's a resident of Rochester, Minnesota. Not so much struggling with the quality of her health care benefit package, but more just the financial cost of it. She and her husband make about $39,000 a year, but after their taxes are taken out and after their health care costs, that ends up being about $23,000 that they take home. For Diane, the cost of health care is so significant that she really feels like her family is really starting to slip backwards. We used to consider ourselves middle class, she told us, but now I think we're really part of the working poor, and it's because of health care costs. One final story that I'll share is a woman named Twyla, who's a daycare provider in Hinckley, Minnesota. And for Twyla and her family, the cost of health insurance is so high that her entire family now goes without health care. She takes care of several children in the Hinckley area, but she sometimes charges as little as $2 an hour to care for the children because the families in the area can't necessarily afford to pay more than that. Twyla's entire family is uninsured because she makes just above the level that would qualify her for Minnesota care, and she can't afford to purchase health insurance on her own. She said to us when we spoke with her this spring, you're wondering what my health care problem is? I can't even afford to take my kids to the dentist. So these are just a few of the health care stories that we've heard as we've been talking to families around the state about this issue. And we wanted to come today just to share a few of those stories, just to express our appreciation for the work that this committee is taking on to tackle this very critical and important problem. And the time has really come, as a lot of these stories show us, to move toward good quality, affordable health care for everyone in Minnesota. And we look forward to helping with that on this issue by trying to engage as many community members around the state of Minnesota on this issue to get more engaged in it so we can all be working together to improve the quality of health care in our state.
Ms. Joy, when your folks are talking to people at the door about health care and are most of the people who are you raising the issue of health care, or are they raising it? In other words, are you going door to door to talk health care or other things?
We are going door to door and talking only about health care. That's the issue that we're raising. And okay. Our folks knock on the door, share a story that they have with their own family about health care, and then ask the people at the door, what has health care meant for you and your family? And then they talk more about how can we get more engaged in this issue, and what are some opportunities for you to get more involved in your community.
How many of the people who express problems with are people like this woman in Hinckley who is, she said she was totally uninsured, her family's totally, how many of the people who are expressing access problems in their own case are people who are in that shape, and how many are the ones, like one of your other stories, they had coverage but didn't cover transplants?
So I would say the large majority of people that we've spoken to have some kind of health insurance. And but what we've realized in the course of those conversations, I'm sure all the members of the committee have kind of heard similar things, is having health insurance on paper isn't protecting them against medical debt anymore. And there's kind of as the benefit packages that they have get sort of more and more full of holes in what's covered, caps on the level of coverage, that even the people who will say, we have health insurance, are also saying, but I also have thousands of dollars in medical bills.
Mr. Chairman and Ms. Doyle,
I'm really going to be interested to see this data or information that you're going to gather from these 60,000 people. Are you going to forward on that information to the legislature or members of this committee, or what are you going to do with that information? I certainly think it would be helpful if we would see those that information, because I can't speak for other people, but Paul Coring wears his heart on his sleeve, and when I hear these these heart-wrenching stories, it certainly has a huge effect on me. So I'm wondering about that.
Sure. Yeah, we certainly are interested and happy to share all of those stories with all of the members of the legislature interested in hearing them. We started to compile them into kind of a story bank so we can keep track of what folks have told us on the doors. And also are kind of starting to do activities within different communities around inviting members of the community to get together and talk about healthcare, to meet with their legislator in some cases, to talk more about the healthcare crisis, as another opportunity to sort of share with the members of the legislature some of those stories more directly. So we'd be happy to continue to do that.
Sure. Thank you very much. Senator Hand.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and Ms. Doyle. Just your organization, I apologize, I'm not familiar with it, but do you have a particular policy direction that your organization is interested in implementing? Are you, in addition to talking to people, trying to suggest certain kinds of directions that we ought to pursue as far as solutions? Do you have, a point of view on what the direction is that we need to take?
Mm-hmm. So, we are, at this point, interested in supporting everything that's going to move us toward improving the quality, improving the access, and reducing the cost of healthcare to individual families around the state. And that is, as we are talking to folks at the door about this issue, that is what we're talking about, is supporting a policy direction that's going to move us significantly forward in achieving good quality, affordable healthcare for everyone in the state.
Thank you very much, Ms. Doyle.
Thank you very much.
We have Alphonse Mathewitz. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, and I want to thank you for coming out here, hearing our concerns about health care. I'm Alphonse Mathewitz. I'm a semi-retired farmer. I live 7 miles east of Comfrey in tornado country. We were wiped out in 1998. We lost our building site, and we lost most of our machinery. 4 years ago, my wife had cancer surgery, and 2.5 years ago, I applied for some life insurance. And they come out, and I had a physical, and I got a letter stating that my PSA count is above normal. So I went to my family doctor, and he recommended me, a urologist that comes to New Ulm Medical Clinic from Mankato. So I met with him. We took the PSA count, and it kept going up. So the urologist recommended that I have a biopsy, and the biopsy showed cancer. So then they made me suffer another week before I could go and meet with them to see what my options were to take care of this cancer. And being I was over 70 years old, they didn't recommend surgery. So either I had implants or radiation or they call it a Lupron shot. And the word cancer scares me, so I wanted to do the quickest thing I could, so I decided to take that Lupron shot. And the first ones were 3 months. They cost $900, and then every 3 months I have to get a blood test and go back to see how things are going. And then they talked radiation, and I really didn't care to go to radiation because it was coming into the winter season, so I stayed on the shots. Then they gave me a 4 month Lupron shot, which cost $1,200, and then this urologist, he comes to New Ulm Medical Clinic, so I thought, why should I drive to Mankato? I made an appointment to meet him in New Ulm Medical Clinic, and then he said, well, my PSA count is on the way down, but he recommended another Lupron shot. So I said, can I get this here in New Ulm? Same thing I've been getting down in the Mankato Clinic. Yeah, he said. So I went to the chemotherapy department, so I got that shot. I didn't think nothing of it until we got the paperwork about 2 weeks later. And that shot was $9,535 and some cents, and I just about fell off the chair. And I called the building department in New Ulm, and I said, in fact, I went down there And I said, that's got to be a mistake. It can't be that much. You know, well, they looked it up. You know, that's what it is. Then I called Alina down in the Golden Valley, and they looked it up, and I said, that's got to be a mistake. I said, 4 months before this, I got the same shot for $1,200. And well, he said he couldn't help me. Then he said I was supposed to write a letter to the clinic, and I said, who do I write it to? Well, he didn't know, so I called up the clinic and got a name, and I wrote a letter stating that there has to be a mistake here because that don't seem right. And then I said in the letter that I may not die of cancer, but I could die of a heart attack getting bills like this. And, well, I 10 days, and I didn't receive any call or anything, so I went down to the New Orleans Medical Clinic billing department. I had the bill from Mankato Clinic. I had my statement from the New Orleans Medical Clinic, and I had the letter. And I asked if this gentleman was here in this office or if he's down in the cities or someplace, because with these mergers, you don't know who you're dealing with. Well, he had an office there in Wallam, and a bookkeeping lady, secretary, she took the papers in there, and then a little while she come back out, and she said, he wants to meet with you. Well, I said, I'd like to meet with him, too. And we sat down, and I said, this is something wrong. Well, he said it could have went up. Well, yeah, I said, I can't argue that point, but I don't think it went up $8,400. And, well, I said, I'm not coming back here no more. You know, well, he said, you wouldn't do that. I said, just watch me. And then he said, well, we'll give you the next shot for $1,200. I said, how good is your word? Well, we stand behind it. Well, I found out how good the word was. I went down there and got the next shot, and I got the bill. It was $9,600-some again. Itemized statement, the shot itself was $9,500-some. So I had another appointment there in New Orleans Medical Clinic with my urologist, and he and a blood test always before, and he said, we'll give you another 4 month shot. And I said, you ain't gonna do it here. And he said, why not? Well, I said, by golly, when they charge that much more than down in Mankato Clinic, I said, I'm not going to have a shot here. And I made an appointment in Mankato. 2 days later, I had a shot down there. It took a while to get the paperwork, and the shots were still $1,200. And I'd like to know what's going on. I can't get an answer from anybody, and I think this is highway robbery in broad daylight. And I refuse to go back for that shot in New Orleans Medical Clinic, and they're still $1,200. And that's my concern, and I think when I tell people this, they can't believe it. Well, I can't believe it either, but I like to have somebody account to me why. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Mathewitz. First of all, I would like if you could give us your maybe address, give our staff your address and phone number so we could contact you, because I'd like to know more about that too. I think that's absolutely outrageous. But I have a question about you. You talked about contacting Alina. In other words, you have health coverage through
Alina. We got
Alina.
Medicare and Medicare supplement.
Supplement through Alina.
And on the $1,200 bills, Medicare paid $800 and then supplement paid $400. And then when they sent that $9,500 or $9,600 one in, you know, they charged $100 to give it to you. And the Medicare supplement paid $7,500 and the Medicare paid $7,500 and the supplement paid the other $2,000. So, and my agent called Medicare and I asked, why are they paying on the same shot, 4 month shot, same thing, you know. On one of them, they'll pay $800, and then the next shot, when they send the bill in, then they pay them $7,500. But we don't get no answers from anybody, and I think something's got to be done. And if you want my phone number is 507-877-4043.
Okay, maybe you can give our staff that too so we can get in touch. But I think there are other members of the committee that have more questions about this too.
Mr. Chairman, I'm pretty upset over this. Can I give you my card and can you photocopy that information, that the letter that you sent to that guy and those bills? And I will tell you that this committee, or I will get to the bottom of this, and we will have an answer for you.
Well, I'd sure like to get one. This has been going on for...
Kent, if you could give him my card and my address on, and send, if you can make photocopies and send that to me, this is ridiculous. We're going to get to the bottom of this.
Thank you again for listening to our concerns out here.
And Mr. Matthews, I think I heard Congressman Walz as a staff member. I don't know who that is, but I might suggest that they do it too, because long before he got into Congress, Congress did pass the Medicare Part D stuff. They actually prohibited the federal government from negotiating prices with pharmaceutical companies. Unlike what Veterans Administration, everybody else does, federal law prohibits the federal government from negotiating. So if they charge $9,500, that's what they pay.
Well, somebody made the statement that some places can charge more than others for the same product. No, I don't know how that works. And talk
it's
about
not
the,
right.
The VA. I wanted some help from the VA some years back, and the first question the VA officer asked me, how much was your income last year? You know, and well, I had my income tax. This was in March. And I said, what's your magic number? And he told me, and I was above that. Sorry, we can't help you. And I'll tell you, that really made me bitter about the VA, and I have never went back. I'm a veteran, and they didn't tell me that they wasn't going to, you know, take
care of my
health.
The commitment was we were going to take care of veterans, period.
Thank you again.
Thank you very much for your testimony. Sarah Cruz.
Okay. I can tell you
oh.
That she is coming. She's United Way. We're
going to
talk
on behalf of the Okay. Lynn Vandervoort from Senior Federation. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you.
Looks like you have some handouts, too.
I do.
That's very disturbing. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Thank you for allowing me to speak with you today. My name is Lynn Vandervoort, and I am the director of the Minnesota Senior Federation's South Central Region, which is part of the statewide network of regions. We directly serve 18 counties in South Central and Southeastern Minnesota, the vast majority being rural, with the values and culture that make up Greater Minnesota. I listen daily to seniors who call or stop by with problems in their lives. 90% of the contact we have with seniors involves a healthcare issue, and of this contact, two issues rise to the top: the exorbitant cost of prescription drugs and Medigap insurance issues. The Minnesota Senior Federation has been in existence for over 30 years. What's sad is that when our grassroots membership identified issues at the birth of this organization, their number one concern was access to affordable healthcare. All these years later, the same issue remains a top priority, which is not a lot of progress. At one point, seniors had to choose between paying for health care or paying the tax bill. These days, it doesn't matter which choice they make, because the skyrocketing rates associated with both of these issues leave seniors with no acceptable choice. That's another issue for another committee, but you should know it plays a role in any policy that allocates resources. Medigap insurance costs impact the independence of seniors, and ultimately we all pay part of the burden. High insurance rates deplete the hard-earned and scrupulously saved resources of seniors at an alarming rate, with the end result being dependence upon Medicaid, a line item which impacts state budget resources and the taxes we pay. Federal authorities, to their credit, have been looking at how to better manage paying for health care, and Minnesota has been at the forefront of some of these changes. But these stopgap measures will not hold back the tidal wave of spending ahead of us. In our country right now, someone is turning 60 every 4.6 seconds. Think about that. In 2003, the Center for Rural Policy and Development documented rural counties with a senior population that made up 12 to 28% of the total county population. By 2030, our youngest urban centers will include 14% of people age 65 and over, while rural areas in Minnesota will see seniors make up as much as 34% of the population. That's one of every three people. If Medigap insurance is unaffordable today, what will it be in 2030? How fast will we run through private savings accounts? How soon will the state feel the influx of a population dependent upon Medicaid? How high will our taxes go? The comprehensive zero premium Medicare Advantage plans have holes in the coverage that leave seniors vulnerable. I spoke to one woman who went to a nursing home for rehab after a knee replacement, only to find her Advantage plan didn't cover the stay. The result was a bill for thousands of dollars of uncovered care, a bill she neither expected, was not prepared to pay, nor did she feel she was adequately informed that she would be responsible for these costs. Here we go. This is Healthcare Choices. It's 122 pages. It documents the myriad of healthcare decisions that seniors need to make. I have spent hours helping seniors chart the options they face, and almost all of them ask, "What should I do?" When I tell them I can't make the decision for them, I've seen responses ranging from disgust to frustration to the verge of tears. The system is complex. To some, it's overwhelmingly complex. On the other hand, to others, the range of choices gives them the flexibility they desire, and that's important. We need to offer a range of options to people. Our country and Minnesota prides itself on the ability of its citizens to make independent choices and take care of themselves. My advice to anyone who asks, "What should I do?" is always the same. First, I tell them nothing in life is free, and all of them agree with that statement. Second, I tell them that only they know the state of their health. There are insurance options which are cheaper for people who are healthy, or at least those who think they are healthy. This means that seniors need to guess at which healthcare option will be the most affordable based upon their individual state of health. I think it's sad that we've made insurance affordability a health guessing game, which risks either home or health if your guess is not exactly accurate. Any real health reform package must include access not only to affordable Medigap coverage, but also needs to address the high costs of prescription drugs. The efforts of Governor Pawlenty to make importation of prescription drugs from Canada an option should be applauded as a bold move that brought this issue some national attention, and clearly the Minnesota Senior Federation is well known as an organization that provides bus trips to Canada and offers a drug importation program with the parapharmacies in Canada. But it's not enough. We have some members of the Minnesota Senior Federation who are 5 and 6 years old. We don't expect they will need retirement counseling anytime soon, but they joined to take advantage of our prescription drug benefit. I myself joined in order to save on Flonase, and my 18-year-old daughter is considering joining as well because we are unsure if her catastrophic health insurance will cover the Advair disc she needs to stay out of an emergency room with an asthma attack. And will this be before or after her $10,000 deductible is met? All of these allergy and asthma medications are 40 to 60% cheaper by purchasing them in Canada, and none of them are cheap. An Advair disc in Minnesota will run $250. The Veterans Administration already negotiates bulk rates for men and women who have served their country, but why limit this ability to one set of people? For any comprehensive health coverage to be considered viable, we must address the way in which we pay for our prescription drugs. An item that needs to be addressed for seniors in rural Minnesota, a problem not necessarily in healthcare, but one that directly impacts access to healthcare, is the lack of a comprehensive vision on transportation and the role it plays in accessing healthcare. While it's relatively easy for seniors in Mankato to get to a doctor's office, it's another story if they need to travel from Blue Earth to Rochester. As soon as you leave the city limits, or worse, once you cross a county line, it becomes glaringly clear that not only does the system not work, even worse, there really isn't much of a system at all. The first choice for seniors facing this obstacle is family or friend. But by 2030, if 1 in 3 in the counties with the highest senior population over 65 are over 65, and the other person is driving them to an appointment, then we need to figure out how to sustain this economy with the last remaining individual. Clearly, there is room for improvement, and available resources are not being used in the most efficient manner possible. We know how to move thousands of people around a metro area. Surely we can figure out how to cost-effectively get people to Rochester's Mayo Clinic
in a timely manner that won't exhaust the patience and resources of families and friends. Last, I would like to emphasize the need for adequate dental coverage. The Minnesota Senior Federation recently began to offer an affordable dental insurance to our members. For too long, most dental treatments have been thought of as cosmetic, and nothing could be further from the truth. Periodontal disease is a known factor in heart disease and a serious medical issue for people with diabetes. Periodontal disease is best kept at bay by providing adequate coverage for people to get their teeth cleaned at least twice a year. Currently, if you have medical assistance or Minnesota Care, in reality, you don't have dental coverage because very few dentists accept it. Comprehensively addressing any health care effort will mean addressing this issue. Thank you for your time. Thank you for listening. Color handouts that I showed are available online at the Atlas of Minnesota, a service of the Center for Rural Policy and Development in St. Peter. And remember, since I started talking, 65 people in the country turned 60 years old.
Thank you, Ms. Vandervoort. I think your illustration in this book is pretty powerful. When I think a lot of seniors like to think of retirement as a time to enjoy, not a time to spend looking through charts and trying to figure something out.
And
the choices are important, but this is...
And what's interesting is that this is actually an award-winning publication, because it lays it out in a manner that's relatively easy to understand and access. It's probably the best publication that seniors can get.
Thank you. Senator Corrin.
Mr. Chairman, I don't seem like I'm talking all the time. It's just so that this is so good, because you're sparking a lot of good ideas. And I just wanted to address this to the committee members. I don't think we realize how important it is for somebody to have dental coverage, because if you don't have dental coverage and you don't take care of your teeth, there's a lot of people that have an abscess tooth or something, and they wind up in the emergency room, and then we're all paying for it. So it's so important that we provide this coverage for people. So I would just say this is something that this committee should certainly be trying to figure out. This is one issue right here on dental coverage that this committee should be working on and forward on to Senator Bergman.
I would just say health insurance policy with a $10,000 deductible is not a health insurance policy, it's a bankruptcy policy.
Thank you. Thank you very much for your testimony. Robin Miller. Is Robin here? If not, Bob Meyer.
Mr. Chair and committee members, thank you for the opportunity to speak on healthcare access issues. My name is Bob Meyer. I'm the Human Service Director for Blue Earth County here in Mankato. I would like to address two significant issues impacting people with mental health needs in our communities. The first issue is the shortage of psychiatrists in our state. Blue Earth County, along with 9 counties in South Central Minnesota, participate in a project called the South Central Community-Based Initiative. This project was established at the direction of the Minnesota Department of Human Services to move adults out of the regional treatment centers and serve them in their home communities. Our project has been very successful in finding alternative community-based options to serve persons with mental illness. We have achieved and maintained an 80% reduction in regional treatment center bed use in the last decade, with most of that reduction occurring in the first few years of our project. We have been able to achieve this result because of the significant funding and human resources deployed from the state-operated services of the Department of Human Services. The local mental health provider community has also risen to the challenge by filling many of the service gaps that resulted from the shift to a community-based service model. We believe we could do even more, be more successful in this effort, and improve the overall quality of the community-based system of care for mentally ill if we had more psychiatric resources available. I'm sure you are aware that Minnesota has a lower number of psychiatrists per capita than other states. graduates from the University of Minnesota psychiatry program are being recruited nationally and are oftentimes leaving our state. Without psychiatric services available on a timely basis, we struggle to support our people in our communities. Wait times of up to 3 months to see a psychiatrist lead to more inpatient stays and other more costly treatment interventions. We have attempted to augment our limited psychiatric options with advanced practice nurses and certified nurse specialists, which have really helped a lot, but these practitioners are also in short supply. We believe there needs to be additional incentives established to encourage individuals to pursue careers in psychiatric or psychiatry and practice in our state. We see this as a problem that will continue to grow if something isn't done soon. The number of psychiatrists retiring is exceeding the number of new psychiatrists entering practice. This problem also impacts the second issue that I'd like to talk to you today. That issue is the access to inpatient mental health beds. Our community recently suffered a severe blow for accessing inpatient mental health care when our hospital closed its behavioral unit. The reason for the closure was based on the loss of psychiatrists to support those beds. The Mankato Clinic psychiatrist historically supported the beds at the hospital, but because of our retirement and relocations, their ability to continue to support the inpatient care was compromised. As a result, persons experiencing mental health crisis who required inpatient care have been transported to all parts of Minnesota and even placed as far away as Sioux Falls and Fargo. It is well known that prognosis improves when people recover near their home. We all appreciate the support and encouragement of family and friends, but that is very hard to accomplish when you're half a state away or more. I'm happy to report that ISJ Mayo Health Systems recently reopened a 6-bed behavioral unit, but this is less than half the capacity previously and serves a very large catchment area. The problem is again a statewide issue with ripples that originate in the metro region. As beds in the metro region fill up, patients are sent to other parts of the state, which leads to local beds being filled and our local patients being sent to other parts of the state and even out of state. We need a full continuum of care available and adequate capacity to address the complex needs of persons with mental illness, and we need to serve them in their home communities. Our community understands these are complex issues, but we also believe these concerns can be addressed by building strong networks of care at the local level. We specifically need help building and maintaining the resources necessary to support an infrastructure that assures quality care and access to needed treatment. We appreciate the efforts of the Department of Human Services and the legislature to pass legislation this session that will reform and increase funding in the mental health system. We trust that those efforts will continue to evolve and specifically target the two significant concerns that I've discussed here today. Again, I want to thank you for the opportunity to present before the committee. I appreciate your time here today.
Thank you very much, Mr. Meyer. Questions from the committee? I really appreciate it. And the point about having access to providers and facilities is one we haven't talked about a lot here, but it's a pretty urgent one. And mental health, I know, this year was the first year we made progress on mental health care, I think, in many years.
It certainly was significant progress, and we appreciate all of that.
Thank you, Mr. Meyer. This is a person who really is able to talk effectively about mental health issues, and it can be a resource to the committee. But what I want to highlight about what you're saying is that Mankato is a regional hub. And if you're having it reported to you that this regional hub where their ISJ Mayo Health System exists, this is the home base for the Mayo Health System that's in this area, cannot keep the psychiatric unit inpatient open, and you don't get that that's a crisis, then we're not listening. because this is a regional hub, and we were for how many months without inpatient psychiatric services. And the effort has been, and I really support this, towards community-based services. But you can't get people care in the community if you can't get clinical nurse specialists, advanced practice nurses, and psychiatry seeing patients and starting medications early enough. So this is a critical issue, increasing funding for and payment for those services, and also recognizing that even though community-based services are very critically important and they're less expensive, there is a need and a place for acute care. People get acutely ill even with the very best outpatient services. And that because we've been so focused on the community-based, we've really abandoned the reimbursement rates for inpatient care. It discourages psychiatrists from doing care inpatient. They prefer outpatient because there's a better reimbursement for that as our incentive basis for encouraging outpatient services or community-based services. So this is a critical issue that needs to be a part of what we address in healthcare policy.
Thank you, Senator Lloyd.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Mr. Meyer, for your testimony. I'd just like to give a very recent example from my district that's been particularly troublesome to me. I had a gentleman with some significant mental health issues calling my office during the session, and was obviously getting more and more trouble during the session, and it came to a point where he was issuing threats to the law enforcement community in my area, to the point where I felt it was incumbent upon me to call the law enforcement and explain to them the situation this guy was in. And I was trying to, I called all over looking for a place for him to receive some mental health services. I mean, it was obvious that that is what was desperately being called for. And I could find none. The sheriff really wanted to find a three-day, 72-hour psyche eval bed. The closest area was Cambridge. They continually said, no, we just don't have room. Our three beds are full. And I called Duluth. I called all over. Jail was the only place for this individual. They had to press charges against him. They put him in jail. This is where these people are being served if we can't provide the acute care needs for our mentally ill across the state. And this gentleman's going to be facing more and more troubles, and has still not received the care, the mental health care and treatment that I believe he deserves. And it's been particularly troublesome to me as I tried to track this particular case. So it is something that's come home to me personally. I thought I'd share that story.
Well, I appreciate that. We certainly see that the jail inmate population is a population that has mental health needs, and there's a lot of federal focus on how do we bring more services, mental health service students, to the jail population. I'd like to see that even go further if possible.
Thank you very much. Did either Sarah Cruz arrive yet, or Ms. Miller? If you want to come, welcome to the committee. And then I had Glenn Peterson, who signed in when he came here, and then beyond that we have people who, anybody else who has not signed up but would like to speak. Welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself, and we're asking people to try and keep it to 3 minutes, but as you've been able to hear, we haven't been very strict on that.
Well, thank you for inviting me today. My name is Sarah Cruz. I'm the administrator for Open Door Health Center. And I know that you have already heard from our physician earlier, so I will try not to be redundant on the things she spoke on. I will speak more big picture and then also toward the dental needs that we see. If it wasn't already addressed, Open Door, the budget for Open Door comes from a number of sources. People who have income levels up to 200% are placed on a sliding fee scale. And we also have been designated as an FQHC lookalike clinic, which gives us a slightly increased reimbursement for Medicaid patients. That does not impact any of our uninsured, and many of our patients that we see would be uninsured as well. Our budget is heavily dependent on grants and donations, which makes it somewhat of a fragile safety net, but that's really what we see the clinic as, is that safety net for anybody who can't find access in the community. And in dental, that safety net has been difficult to manage. You've already heard I was here for a testimony right when I walked in regarding dental needs, and I would echo all of the things that were spoken there regarding those that have a state type of program, managed program, that there is not access for them even though they have the insurance. Open Door has greatly struggled to find dental providers to come to our community. The main reason for that is because of what we're able to offer them in terms of salary. It's much less than what they would make in private practice. And so we've really struggled, and that struggle to find providers has not allowed us to keep up with the need. Our waiting list has reached 200 people from time to time. We currently book 5 months out. And even last night as I was preparing, I had an email message from a patient who's been trying hard to get in, has extreme needs, and we still are putting them on the waiting list trying to find someone in the community maybe to come in and take care of that extreme need. We do have to balance some things too as far as appointment lengths and education needs. Our patients have not had the education that they should have for many conditions, but dental is another one of those. So the challenge is productivity versus education, when perhaps the education would help do more for the prevention in the long run. And so we do struggle with that. So I think I'll just keep it short and sweet, and I know you have others that will want to speak. If you have questions, you can certainly ask, but that dental piece along with that medical piece is a very real need in our area. So.
Thank you very much, Ms. Cruz. Are there questions from members of the committee? Can I ask roughly what the budget is and how many you served? I heard 5,900 patients you served.
Right. This year we're about $850,000 for the organization as a whole. So, and about half of our population is dental, half medical. In dental, we have about 50% that have a Medicaid-type program. So it could be Delta Dental or Durell, which are the managed care programs that take care of those folks that are on Medicaid. In the medical area, it's more like 20% that have insurance. We do not take any private commercial insurance in dental. We do allow some in the medical, although the numbers are probably around 1%. Our focus truly is on the uninsured and in that Medicaid portion of our population here. Our reach extends, I suppose you heard, but out to 10 counties. So it's not just Mankato, although probably the three closest counties besides Blue Earth would be our greatest draw, but we do have people who travel 45 minutes to an hour to come to us because they haven't found a resource to go to for their needs.
Thank you very much for your testimony.
Thank you.
Did Robin Miller arrive? St. Peter? Gwen Peterson, not sure where you're from, but welcome to the committee.
Thank you for that welcome, Senator Marty. And as a faculty member at this university and a colleague of Senator Sharon, I hope I can also appropriately say welcome to you and to the committee members, and thank you for being here in Mankato to listen to the comments of people from our surrounding area. Senator Marty, in respect to the ground rules that you attempted to lay out at the beginning of this meeting, where I believe you asked that comments do not reflect any specific pieces of legislation, I will delete some of the comments that I intended to offer in that regard. If I understand correctly, you suggested that specific policies not be addressed, but rather
general concerns. You can express specific policies. I don't want to limit it too much. I just want to keep it.
Well, I will somewhat temper the comments I might otherwise offer in regard to my advocacy for single-payer universal coverage. I think, Kathy?
No, I was just teasing you a little bit. It's okay.
Just a little bit? I think you asked that we speak to the principles or the ideals that we would like to see in a healthcare system that hopefully Minnesota is maybe moving toward, and I will endeavor to do that. I will also try to, on the fly here, organize and edit some of the material I brought with me to try to stay within that 3-minute time frame. And maybe I'll start with one of the broadest and most general points that I'd like to make. in response to your suggestion, what would we like to see? What do we suggest in a healthcare system that Minnesota might be moving toward? And I would like to suggest a healthcare system that totally disregards the concept of healthcare being a commodity to be brokered in a marketplace primarily for the generation of profit. Rather, I would like to suggest moving toward and building a healthcare system that sees healthcare as a basic human right and as part of what I would like to refer to as a societal social infrastructure. We don't use that term social infrastructure too much in the United States, but if you Google the term, you'll find that it is frequently used in other industrial and Western countries. And you'll further find that in discussion of the societal infrastructure that is built in a majority of those additional Western and industrialized countries, that access for all citizens to affordable health care that meets all of their health care needs is a part of that societal infrastructure. I would suggest that we can do the same. Let me take this just a step further. What are we talking about when we say moving beyond a system that views healthcare as a commodity to be brokered in a marketplace primarily for the purpose of profit? I think some of the important points have already been touched upon. Senator Marty, you began this meeting by talking about the fact that of bankruptcies in the United States, 50% are caused by healthcare expenses that people can't meet. You further pointed out that among those 50%, that approximately 3/4 of those individuals have health insurance. Let's reflect on that incredibly important, that incredibly profound point. So often the discussion of universal coverage talks about providing health insurance for everybody. But that fact that you pointed out illustrates that just having health insurance is not always the answer to providing people with the health care needs that they will incur in a variety of situations, including some of the situations that have been personally spoken to by speakers in this meeting. The first speaker, Dr. Vogel from Open Door, talked about a number of her experiences and observations. One that she left out, very possibly in regard to time constraints, was actually a story that was illustrated, and I have it here while I'm fumbling through my papers, in the front page of our local newspaper, the Mankato Free Press, a little over a year ago. And it's the story about a person who is receiving health care services at the Open Door Clinic, one of many. And it describes, here it is, I have a copy of this if you'd like to see it. It describes the experience of a person who not only had the limits and the caps of her health insurance kick in so that she was no longer able to receive the appropriate treatments at, you know, through the same systems and providers that she had been receiving, but that the costs that were incurred with reaching the limits of her health insurance caused her family to lose their home, to lose the resources that they had been building through their employment, through their savings, through their hard work and efforts. This is not an isolated incident. I can speak to it from personal, but fortunately, second person experience. My wife and I are very fortunate. We both work at this university. We both have jobs that we enjoy, and our employment allows us to maintain a comfortable, not extravagant, but very comfortable and secure, at least for now, lifestyle. We're tremendously grateful for that. Among the things that we've been able to do is to purchase a small, very modest, second investment rental income just a couple of blocks from this campus. As our daughter prepares to enter college next year and we adjust to becoming empty nesters, we'll very possibly at some point move into that smaller house than the one that we live in now, and live close to work, and again, be very comfortable and secure, at least for now. The couple that rent our house from us, a very hardworking, very honest, very typical middle-class couple, are renting from us because, again, he got sick as a part of aging, retired with a medical retirement, hit the caps in his insurance. She's of retirement age and would like to retire but can't. They lost every single cent that they had saved over a lifetime. They lost the house that they had purchased, raised their family in, and intended to retire comfortably in, simply because of health care costs. So when we talk about the difference between a marketplace in which health care is brokered as a commodity versus a healthcare system in which the access to the services that we need are a basic human right, let's be clear, we're talking about a current system in operation in the United States that allows people to work all their lives, to pay their taxes, to play by every rule that society imposes, and to lose everything simply because the illnesses that we know are inevitable wipe them out. That's not right. Why does this happen? What's the other side of the equation here in terms of that marketplace in which healthcare is a commodity and brokered? Well, I can tell you one thing that happens. Perhaps members of the committee have seen from January 14th of 2007, the annual report that's published in the Star Tribune on the nonprofit corporations, the top 100 nonprofit corporations in Minnesota. And if you look at this, what you'll see is that the largest revenue grossing nonprofit corporation in Minnesota is Blue Cross Blue Shield of Minnesota. You'll also see that the CEO of Blue Cross Blue Shield had an annual compensation package of $3,365,811. Senator, I won't earn that much money in my lifetime. But here's one healthcare executive bringing in almost $3.5 million in 1 year. Health Partners, the third largest, CEO annual compensation, $1,140,000. Allina Health Systems, CEO annual compensation, $1,575,000. Medica, CEO compensation, $1,012,000. Essentia Health, CEO annual compensation, $1,042,000. Health East, CEO annual compensation, $1,029,000. How many $1 million a year healthcare insurance or HMO executives do we need to have to provide the healthcare services to people and at the same time allow hardworking middle-class Minnesotans to lose their homes, to lose everything they've worked for? This is wrong. I would suggest to you that the reason it's wrong goes back to that fundamental philosophical approach to healthcare. Is healthcare a commodity to be brokered in a marketplace that primarily is in place to generate profits so that executives can haul in multi-million dollar a year salaries? And we're not even talking about United Health Group and the for-profit sector and the $100 million a year that its CEO enjoyed for no fewer than 5 years in a row. The $1.5 billion in unexercised stock options. That's the kind of profit that our current healthcare system generates, while saying we can't afford to provide everybody with the health care coverage that meets all of their health care needs. So what would I like to see in a health care system? I'd like to see a health care system that totally rejects the argument we can't afford to provide everybody with the entirety of their health care needs. That is untrue. Let me illustrate. Just
can you be brief, because I do want to see if there are others in the audience who have not signed in, but who would like to go ahead quickly.
I'll be brief in finishing. Thank you. Healthcare in the United States, by one of the most recent studies, is shown to cost $2 trillion per year. With 300 million citizens, that breaks down to approximately $7,000 per person in the United States for the costs of operating our annual system of healthcare. That is approximately a third more than the second most expensive system, which is Switzerland, and it's at least twice as much as the majority of the Western industrialized nations. Canada, for example, is $2,500 per person per year. The argument that we'll hear from special interests and the marketplace is, but we don't want a system like Canada. Well, that's interesting. I happen to have here the study that was conducted by a team of researchers from Canada and the United States that shows across a majority of healthcare measures that in empirical studies published in peer-reviewed journals, that the systems actually are not terribly discrepant in terms of overall quality, but that on the balance, Canada actually comes out higher. Very consistent with the fact that the World Health Organization found the United States to be the 37th best system in terms of overall quality, far behind the rest of the Western world and just below Colombia and Costa Rica. So we're spending twice as much as a majority of the Western world. We're getting less quality. In concluding, Senator, I would like to suggest to you, and I would like to suggest to the committee, as you continue this very important work that you're doing and have meetings like this and gather the information that's going to be so critical to the decisions that you'll be making in looking at how we can build a better healthcare system in Minnesota, I would ask that you look into the factors that relate to having far and away the most expensive system in the world, but a system whose quality is far below much of the Western and industrialized world, and ask yourself, does the fact that this is the only Western industrialized nation that treats healthcare as a commodity rather than as a basic human right that the government is responsible to protect have something to do with it? I know I took over my time. I appreciate your patience. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Peters. And yes,
Mr. Chairman, just
Mr. Chairman, very quickly, and Mr. Peterson, I want to thank you for your testimony. I wish everybody was as passionate as you are, and I'm not speaking negatively of your comments. Don't take it that way. But I will just say that I have found, you know, I certainly haven't been here on this in the Senate as long as some members have, but I will tell you that this. For example, all the kids that are going to this college right now, I think they're paying too much in tuition. And how do we fix that? More money. I think that K-12, at least I can speak for my district, they're going to be laying off teachers. They're going to try to pass a operating levy, and there's not enough money there. So how much is enough? A lot of people say, our roads are crumbling. We need more money for roads. Raise the gas tax. Okay. Healthcare. But my question is the state budget we just passed was about a 10% increase. How much can we afford to pay? If we want the government to do everything for us, which I don't, I just don't think government, because I'm in the government and I can see how inefficient that government does things, and I just I'm just throwing that out there. You know, how much is enough? I mean, do we want Big Brother to do everything for us? And I just don't think it can happen.
Senator, with all due respect, I would suggest to you that first of all, we do not need more money in our healthcare system in order to provide everyone, not just the 84% of the population that currently has access to healthcare coverage. We can take the existing $2 trillion that our healthcare system costs, and we can provide every single man, woman, and child in this country, not only with the healthcare that their current insurance policies provide. We can take away the caps. We can take away the gaps. We can take away the limitations in healthcare coverage. And we can provide for all of the needs of all of the people with the existing money. If we move away from a marketplace, profit-building, million-dollar a year generating private sector CEO salaries, and put that in, you say you don't want government to do everything, and I understand that. What I'm suggesting is a model in which we look at healthcare similar to the way we look at public education, similar to the way that we look at police and fire protection.
I don't want to get this into a debate about healthcare things. I think there are clearly some inefficient, when Ms. Sowell talked about taking a young man who lives within a mile of two dental clinics to Savage, 63 miles away for healthcare, there are a lot of inefficiencies in our system. But with that, I appreciate your testimony. I do want to ask if there were, we did not specifically tell everybody entering the room that we'd like them to sign up. And so if anybody wants to quickly come up, if somebody had come here to give testimony was not told they were to sign up, we still have a couple minutes if one or two of you want to come briefly. Somebody in the back had their hands up. And while you're coming up, I will say the committee received a letter from a Karen Hansen from Waseca, who apparently heard about the hearing. It was apparently listed in paper there or something, but she wrote her testimony and asked if I'd read. I'm not going to go through the whole thing, but she says, in November 2006, I lost my job due to a health issue, suffered a torn meniscus, which would require be off for 6 to 8 weeks for surgery, retained health insurance till the end of November, which covered the majority of the cost of the procedure, also diabetic, cost of medication can run $300 to $400 a month, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And now she talks about, we're no longer looked on as people, but as accounts that need to be paid. There's no effort on the part of the facilities or the state to help people pay the bill. I owe at least $10,000 in old medical bills that I could not pay. Anyway, that's some woman in Waseca expressed that concern and said she couldn't be here, but asked if we could at least give her testimony. Anyway, welcome to the committee, and please identify yourself.
I'm Jackie Edwards. I'm a long-term care administrator in the southern Minnesota area, and I will not take long. I just want this group of people here to understand that the government of Minnesota pays for edging up to 75% of the long-term care health of us in Minnesota, and I'm not sure that they would be aware that only Minnesota and North Dakota are rate equalized. And in our wisdom of trying to make things more efficient, we went from a 13 level of care system to a 36 level of care system. If you have two people enter the nursing home today, both needing that same level of care, and the state of Minnesota will pay $100 a day for that care, that's all we can charge anyone else. But at the same time, when there is a freeze on the amount of money that goes into long-term care, which I know your money needs to go many places, and then the money that does come to us, 75% of that goes to, as a rule, wages and benefits. And when you get 1% and you have 75% of the 1% go to that, it's really sad when out of a group of 600 employees in this group of homes, only 12 people are able to take family health care because it's too unaffordable. So you have a huge problem, and I know that, but I wanted this group to understand that there's a lot that we need to do. We need to get out there and be talking with all of you about the many problems that are faced by many people. But when we all age, and then when I look at the statistic that scared me a little bit, is the government of Minnesota paying for almost 75% of the people in long-term care. Well, that's government taxes, and that is us. And the fact that in 2020, for the first time, we're going to tip, and 50% of the people in Minnesota will be 62 or older. And the really scary part of that is only 10% of the population are going to be 0 to 30. So if the tax base is what pays for health care and long-term care, 75% of the people that get there, and 50% have already tipped into that 62, this other 40% is going to tip this way. Nobody's going down the other way. So I have a huge concern about that, and I want the group of people here to understand they need to be looking at reform in long-term care before you can ever solve what you're here to talk about today, because you are paying a bundle, and you're only one of two states in the union who are doing it this way. If we were in Iowa and the state says, I'll give you $100 a day to care for this person, and we look at our budget and say, well, we're not going to make that, we better raise our cost to private pay people, they can do that. Now, the other hand of that is, the more you raise it to private pay people, the sooner they'll be over here needing this care. So it's very complex, but I just want everyone to understand that solving this here for those of us in need, the young, the working class, you're paying for all of this besides, and that's only going to get bigger. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Edwards. I appreciate you raising the long-term care issue, because that's clearly part of health care. It hasn't been raised today. But one quick question. Did you say 12 people out of 600 employees are able to afford
family
coverage?
We pay. They all have single health care, paid almost entirely. But if they want to pick up the family, only about 12 out of 600.
Thank you very much for your testimony. I'll give a chance if any last person did not know they had to sign up and wanted to test. If not, I want to very much thank those of you who came to testify and spend time with the committee. I think speaking on behalf of the committee, we all appreciated it very much. It's very eye-opening. I think, judging from the other members of the committee, hearing that one person is paying $1,200 for a prescription in one place and almost $10,000 in another is shocking. I think the idea of people driving 63 miles to get to a dentist when there's some clinics within a mile away is shocking. I think when we see all the stories of people who are not getting the coverage they need and the problems we have, and we just touched into mental health care, just touched into long-term care, I happen to think that, as one of the witnesses said, that we can afford to cover everybody, and we can do it cheaper than we're doing it now if we take some of the misguided direction we're doing on things. But the committee is going to be having a number of these hearings around the state. It's not too many members, so you don't have to worry. But we are going to be having a number of them, and this is a good start for us. And I know there are going to be a number of proposals for comprehensive health care reform next year, and this is a good starting point for that. So I want to thank you all for your time, and thank you to committee members for coming as well. And with that, the meeting's adjourned.
Who gets these?
This is spent all this year, not just dollars and sales in terms of all the game companies, the emotion of the work we did. Actually, that was the $10,000 work on the box. We had to look at it.